So it becomes some. It's almost as if these treasures are akin to being like different instruments in an orchestra, and they all have their own voice and they all have their own tone. And together, of course, they create the symphony, but they also have more solo appearances at times. So I want to start by going into the first of these limbs, or the first of these treasures, a sati or a mindfulness. And I'm imagining there are those amongst you who are just about mindfulness out. You've probably heard so much about mindfulness. So I'll probably spend a little bit less time with this particular limb than some of the others. This word sati, I just really do want to acknowledge that the word mindfulness, the early translators really struggled to find a single word to translate sati as. And so they borrowed the word mindfulness from the Gospels. And of course, now we're, that horse is out of the barn. And so this is the term that we're kind of landed with. And it's a useful term. But I think that the downside of this term, when we have one word, is that it doesn't really portray the many nuances of mindfulness. That mindfulness is a landscape. It's something much more than just paying attention or observing. It is actually quite a vast landscape that I would want to give you a bit of a flavor of. It's also the most frequently used word in the whole of the Pali Canon, the early texts, which gives us some sense of really how crucial this quality is, because it's the embarkation point for anything at all to change, for anything at all to be understood. Mindfulness is necessary, is needed. This is where we begin to taste what it means to be awake, both inwardly and outwardly. This is where we begin to taste many of the other limbs of awakening. This is where we begin to taste the possibility of the freedom from distress and struggle. Mindfulness is not just about observing, it's about responding. Certainly in the early teachings, there's quite a strong sense of agency held within the landscape of mindfulness. It's not a landscape of passivity, of just watching. There's very much this nuance and this tone of engagement and responsiveness and meeting what is. So I want to just list a few of the primary dimensions of sati that we draw upon as we meet our present moment experience. We could call these as sort of the almost like the functions of mindfulness. And the first of these is developing our capacity for simple knowing. The second significant dimension of mindfulness is protective awareness. The third is investigative awareness. The fourth aspect of mindfulness is learning to reframe cognition. And the fifth of the functions of mindfulness is basically concerned with cleaning up the field of perception. And one that is not so totally mentioned, or mentioned languaged in the early texts that I consider to be a significant aspect of mindfulness is correcting or rebalancing negative attentional bias. So let's just go through these just somewhat briefly. This aspect of mindfulness, which is about simply knowing or an uncluttered knowing, to know a sound as a sound, to know the body as the body, to know a sight as a sight, a thought as a thought. This is something that the encouragement of the teaching is repeated so often throughout the Satipatthana Sutta, this development of this simple, uncluttered knowing. Now, it sounds very simple, but it is really not easy because we see how much most of our knowing is filtered, isn't it? It's filtered through the lens of interpretation, through the lens of judgment, commentary, and through the lens of association and memory, through the lens of how we have known something in the past. Triggering, and this of course triggers our likes, our dislikes, our preferences, our anxieties, and the proliferation of our stories and narratives that guides our actions and reactions and choices and speech. I often feel that simple knowing is perhaps the first and the most significant step of mindfulness, because there's something very powerful that happens in this capacity to simply know something. It's the movement from being immersed, overwhelmed, and identified with experience into a relational way of being with whatever is being encountered in the moment. It is actually the movement into non-identification. This is almost like a rotation of consciousness from being the victim or the owner or the possessor of experience, to a relationship with the moment that can be palpated with mindfulness, where there can be curiosity and a befriending of the moment. Sometimes sati is translated as our ability to bear something in mind. Our ability to bear something in mind without our attention floating away. Our ability to stabilize our attentional capacity and to stabilize the field of our intentions. To be able to sustain, to be able to sustain, so how often we have like momentary attention and momentary intention. And we love our intentions, and yet how often our attention just floats away. It just floats away. I often feel that one of the most significant developments in people's practice lies in this capacity to sustain both intention and attention, and it is a significant step in the movement towards embodiment. So what we see, intention and attention rise and fall together. When intention is sabotaged, attention, the kind of attention associated with that intention, also falls away. Okay, so you have the intention perhaps of kindness, and you're attending then with kindness to the moment. The moment that the intention is sabotaged, the attention falls away. Or if the attention is sabotaged, the intention falls away. And so one of the great skills of the meditative life or the contemplative life is this ability to learn to sustain both intention and attention. Cultivating this simple knowing moment to moment, we begin actually to see the falling away of much of the agitation, the aversion, and the craving. Because developing that simple knowing is actually unbinding from the narratives, the stories that hold all of those emotional associations and reactions. Now, the second dimension of sati, mindfulness, which is actually equally important, is the domain of protective awareness. Now, it's so important here to distinguish between protective awareness and defensive awareness. Protective awareness is not about sort of hiding, it's not about putting up walls of armor, it's not about pushing the world away. It is about learning to protect the well-being of our own hearts and minds. And the image that is used in the text is the image of the wise gatekeeper that stands at the gates of the city. And the wise gatekeeper welcomes into the city all of the visitors who mean to support and to serve the inhabitants of the city well. And the wise gatekeeper acknowledges the unwelcome visitors to the city, but does not welcome them in. Does not welcome them in. This is the quality of discernment that in the early teachings is really central to sati, to mindfulness. Knowing what leads to distress and what leads to the end of distress. Knowing what supports well-being, knowing what undermines well-being, knowing what leads towards freedom and what leads away from freedom. What leads towards struggle, what leads away from struggle. We have been learning this our whole lives to different degrees, but we haven't always developed the capacity or the skill of being a wise gatekeeper. Discernment is the bridge between mindfulness and wise and skillful response or effort. Without discernment, you know, we are just watching. We are just observing. But we're not making that next step that says, you know, what does this moment actually need? What is helpful to this moment? So discernment is different than judgment. It's not about right and wrong and good and bad. It is the wisdom element of mindfulness. And this is drawing upon our own experience. It's drawing upon our life experience. It's drawing upon our understanding. It's drawing upon the teaching. But we begin to see what leads to distress and indeed what leads to the end of distress. We know what to welcome and what to acknowledge, but not to feed, but not to feed. It's like, again, that you know, image of, you know, someone turning up at your door while you're holding a dinner party, an uninvited guest. You know, it's quite wonderful and kind to offer them a drink of water, but if you offer them a 5-course meal, they're coming back again. You know, and that's where the acknowledgement, but thank you, but no thank you, is actually coming in. Because we can actually really see that by feeding the unwelcome visitors, of course, they are going to return. In protective awareness, there's also a quality of restraint. And again, not the most popular word in our culture. Because this discernment and this restraint that comes from discernment, not feeding the unhelpful, it's not only about protecting our own hearts, it's about protecting our world from the surges of impulse, the surges of reactivity, the surges of craving and ill will, the surges of the veiling factors. So it's about protecting the world, actually, from, you know, that the outcomes of those surges. So there's a deeply ethical element to this restraint. It's not just about, you know, creating a nice, cozy personal space. It's about what kind of footprint we're leaving on the world moment to moment. You know, what are we restraining? We're not restraining creativity. We're not restraining responsiveness. What we are restraining is the surge of patterns that serve neither us well, nor do they serve our world well. So restraint is about protects against the unwholesome taking root and is a key function in the development of ethics, of stillness, of kindness, compassion. Now, the next of these primary aspects of sati is an investigative awareness. Dhammavacaya, which I will actually go into in the next discussion, about reframing cognition and cleaning up the field of perception. Metta, or kindness, is taught as being one of the primary ways of reframing cognition, that which we have seen as an enemy, either outwardly or inwardly, we learn we can befriend. we learn we can actually stand near to without being overwhelmed. Cleaning up the field of perception is about severing the link between perception and emotional history and memory, so that we're not triggered into the same patterns of reactivity over and over again through what we see or meet or encounter. But I will go into these much more as we go along over this weekend. So let's think about investigative awareness, Dhamma Vichaya, or investigation of the Dharmas. It's kind of a long and a slightly awkward phrase to describe what is actually happening within us and around us just now. This is not about a conceptual exploration, but it's deeply experiential. And in one of the texts, the Buddha actually says that investigation is the most important factor of awakening. That investigation is the forerunner of insight and liberation. So the image that's used in the early teachings is very much a medical image of a surgeon treating a wound. So, you know, you can sort of imagine, it doesn't happen so much anymore, that, you know, someone is hit by an arrow and the shaft of the arrow has broken off. And so they go to see a surgeon. So the challenge for the surgeon is to determine the nature of the wound, to be able to make a diagnosis, to be able to offer a prognosis, and to be able to prescribe a course of treatment. So we too learn with mindfulness almost to touch and to palpate every moment of experience. I think of this as an affectionate inquiry. What is going on here beneath the concepts, beneath the assumptions, beneath the conclusions and the images? I think on the widest level, this is a very deep questioning of our lives and ourselves. Why do we think the way we do? Why do we act and react and perceive in the ways that we do? What are the roots of our opinions and our views? Most important question, perhaps of all, why do we struggle? And how would we cease to struggle? Why do we suffer? And what is it that makes us free? So the probe of mindfulness really takes us beneath our current knowing, my beliefs about who I am, who you are, what life is, and begins to reveal what is hidden, the quieter voices of what is hidden. It's almost a process of unknowing, learning to unknow things and to see things anew. The philosopher Wittgenstein, he once said, words deliver us a picture, and the picture holds us captive. Isn't this so true for us? When we believe that we know someone or that we know ourselves, we have a view of another person or we have a view of ourselves. Doesn't it mean that we close the door to learning? In many ways, we actually don't want to be surprised sometimes in life. It feels easier almost to rest in our views or our conclusions or assumptions. When we close the door to learning, and I think this very often happens every time we say, I know you, I know this, I know myself. What is happening is that we find ourselves bound to our images and frozen perceptions. Essentially, we're bound to the past. There are many, many different aspects to Dhamma Vicaya. Again, there's a revisiting and refining of our capacity for discernment. Without this, we're not only bound to a knowing rooted in history, we are also bound to reactions rooted in that history. Think about how this operates in your life. Thanksgiving actually is often a powerful reminder of this. Many of you may not have had family Thanksgivings this year, but in the past, you know what it's like as an adult to return to the family home, and someone in your family, a brother, a sister, a parent, looks at you and says, "I know you. Yeah, I know you." And how their reactions to you or how they hold you is actually rooted in that history and that knowing. We see the repetition of our patterns of aversion, anxiety, greed, dissociation, again triggered by a simple perception. I meet someone I found difficult in the past. I see them. I know them. And I react with the same anxiety or aversion that I've done 1,000 times before. They haven't even opened their mouth. They haven't even done anything. And that same repetition of patterns arise. So investigation of the Dhammas, Dhamma Vicaya, is really interested in why this is so. Is there another way of seeing? Can we change the lens through which we see the world, through which we see ourselves and others? There's so many powerful examples of how this really liberates the moment. And I'm sure you can think of many from your own life where you've suddenly been surprised. You've suddenly been woken up to a new way of seeing. An example I've shared that was so powerful for me a couple of years ago was being in a restaurant in London, and this group of children absolutely rampaging around, screaming at the tops of their voices, knocking into people's tables, seemingly completely out of control. And, you know, you could hear the murmur of complaint and aversion and discontent almost collectively rising. And I thought, I wonder why this is happening. And then I looked around this partition and I saw a group of parents there who had hearing loss, and they were signing to each other and realized they couldn't hear their children. And, you know, seeing that shift from what is going on here to, this is what's going on here. You know, years ago, I was teaching in a kibbutz in Israel, and I had to go to the office one day, and I saw this dog lying outside the office door, and it had a huge growth on its head, this huge tumor on its head. And there was nobody in the office, but I was sort of horrified and appalled, and I thought, and I went away and thinking, you know, what's going on? Oh, you know, they're not caring for their animals, you know, they're just really neglectful, you know, this poor dog needs a vet, you know, and why aren't they organizing this? And I went back to the office several hours later, and there was the dog sitting up quite happily with its tumor on the ground beside it. The tumor was simply a desert stone, the same color as its fur. And to see the sort of almost like the explosion of that world of, you know, this is how it is. Actually, no, it's not. It's not how it is at all. There's a completely different way of seeing this. And I'm sure we've all had moments in our life where, you know, someone who we know as being someone terribly irritable suddenly offers us a great act of kindness or generosity. And we're woken up by those moments when our assumptions and our conclusions are suddenly shattered. Discernment. Talk about this discernment, because this is really what investigation is devoted to developing this capacity for discernment of where things take us, of where the conditions they arise from, of knowing what is helpful and what is unhelpful, what is liberating and what is not liberating, what is healing and what is binding. There's one of the early discourses where the Buddha speaks about almost allowing our thoughts and our words to and our moods, actually, to pass through several gates in the service of developing discernment. And one of the questions that we would ask at those gates is, does this lead to unwholesome states increasing and wholesome states diminishing? Or does this lead to wholesome states increasing and unwholesome states diminishing? Another question or another gate we might ask, is this skillful? Is it unskillful? Is this helpful? Is this unhelpful? Does this lead to the deepening of wisdom? This thought, this mood, this speech? Does it lead to the deepening of wisdom, of understanding? Or does it obstruct wisdom? And perhaps a really important question or gate is to ask of ourselves, does this lead towards the affliction of myself or others? Or does this lead to the end of affliction for myself and others? Does this lead towards freedom or away from freedom? And these are not just speculative questions, although, you know, as a practice, we can actually take it up as a, you know, actually really bringing those gates in. This becomes increasingly intuitive, but it's almost like we need to familiarize ourselves with that landscape of asking the questions that matter. Asking the questions that really are important. And so it is a helpful exercise, you know, when you see a story beginning to arise, or, you know, you're about to speak, and particularly when there's some level of impulse behind that speech or those actions, perhaps to be able to pause for a moment and to bring those gates in. Does this lead to the affliction of myself or others? Or does this lead to the end of affliction of myself or others? Does this lead towards freedom or away from freedom? And perhaps we can start to get somewhat familiarized or at home in this landscape of investigation, rather than just feeling like it doesn't matter. You know, this is a teaching where everything matters. You know, all of our thoughts, all of our speech, all of our actions and choices splinter into thousands of consequences that we often can't even see. And this is also about the kind of footprint we leave upon the world moment to moment, and the kind of imprint that we leave upon our hearts and minds moment to moment. Again, bearing in mind that teaching that what we frequently think about and dwell upon, to this does our mind incline. You can see how mindfulness and investigation, discernment, are all really working hand in hand in the service of healing, in the service of liberation. You know, we see that the most unconscious moments in our lives are the times when we suffer the most. The moments in our lives when we're most awake doesn't mean that we're free of sorrow, but we're free of struggle and blame and regret. I think in the light of this kind of investigation, a pathway begins to open up for us, because we really begin to sense experientially what is worthy to be cultivated and what is not worthy to be cultivated. Again, the link between sati, discernment, investigation, and appropriate response in the service of awakening. here too, we actually encounter again one of the images that represent the nuances of sati mindfulness, the image of the cowherder, who knows really when it's appropriate to guard their herd so that the cows don't trample into fields that are growing crops. And when the cowherder, you know, when it's right for the cowherder to sit back after the harvest and just allow the cows to graze. In the early teachings, investigation is also taking us into the territory of understanding the universal natural laws that we are all part of. Looking closely at experience, we deeply understand that there is nothing that is static, unmoving, eternal, or permanent. The change is written into everything we touch, taste, encounter, see, and experience. We really begin to understand as we look closely at the moment what the Buddha meant by dukkha, the core of the teaching of awakening and the embarkation point of the path. Not about suffering. The most accurate translation of dukkha is a messy space. It's a messy space. Sometimes life is just a messy space, isn't it? Uncooperative, disobedient, at times disappointing, at times other than we want it to be. Just a messy space. Dukkha, some of it is woven into our genetic code. It's woven into our bones. Aging, sickness, death, the inconstancy of all experience, that all experience is born of conditions. And none of us are exempt from this. None of us are entirely in control. And I think that the pandemic has certainly stripped away much of our camouflage, our ways of distracting ourselves, and exposed the fragility of our ideas of control, or somehow being exempt from dukkha. What the Buddha pointed out is that there is dukkha that is not optional. It's woven into our being. But there is a dimension of dukkha that is truly optional. And this is called sankhata dukkha or sankhara dukkha. The patterns of reactivity, the veiling factors, the busyness, the avoidance mechanism we use to try and find an exemption from dukkha. This can end. This can end. Investigation reveals this. What needs to be embraced with compassion and with kindness and with care, and the dimensions of dukkha that truly can end. Non-self. The Buddha talks about you're not going to find an independent self-existence anywhere. You're not going to find an enduring self anywhere. It doesn't mean that we disappear. It doesn't mean that we have no identity. It doesn't mean that we somehow become a kind of blob. But, you know, this our experience keeps showing us this, don't we? I mean, how many selves have you had today? Yeah. Happy self, worried self, sad self, contracted self, spacious self, agitated self, calm self. It's almost like you never know what you're going to wake up to in the morning, don't you? You know, what kind of self is going to be sitting there waiting for you like an old pair of slippers that you just put on? Of course, some of these views of self are very familiar, but only because we've repeated them more often. So they look a little more permanent or a little more real. But actually what we're just seeing is how much repetition they've had. Changing views of who we are, determined by what is clung to, determined by what is identified with. It's interesting the continuum that the Buddha speaks about. You see, if we back up a little bit, he speaks about the ways that craving, ill will, when they intensify, they morph into clinging and identification. That when clinging and identification intensifies, there's the formation of a view of self. And I would really invite you to check that out in your own experience. You know, whenever you find yourself locked into, you know, I am, you know, I am an angry type, you know, or I'm a, you know, I'm a sad type, or I'm a failure, or whatever it is, back up a little bit, you know. What's supporting that? You know, can you see how that is supported totally by clinging and identification? If you can see that, back up a little bit more and see the ways in which craving and aversion, when they intensify, have turned into that identification and clinging. You know, this is part of investigation. The Buddha was so passionate about understanding the architecture of distress. You know, and he says, if we're going to understand the architecture of distress, we really need to see the way in which our world of experience is being constructed and built moment to moment. And in that constructing process of a view of self, a view of the world, you know, we can go through this intensification process and remembering that our view of self shapes our view of the world, shapes our view of others, often shapes our view of life itself. There is a great freedom found in understanding this architecture, because then we actually see that we hold in our hands different pathways that we can follow. We hold in our hands you know, the potential for these seven treasures to be cultivated. That, you know, dukkha is something that is created and recreated moment to moment through a lack of mindfulness, through a lack of understanding. And when understanding and mindfulness is present, we actually no longer need to be so seemingly bound to that constructing process that takes us to places far from where we wish to be. There's a great freedom to be found in that understanding of change, of conditionality and non-self, to allow that to sink into our bones. Because this is where we begin to see the end of clinging, the end of contractedness and fear. And there's also wonder. You know, when we are able to step back from all of that knowing, all of that freezing, all of those images and concepts, this is where we really have the capacity to begin to see anew. And there is a sense of wonder in seeing anew. Now, James Blake once said that when the doors of perception are cleansed, the world appears as it is, infinite. And when the doors of perception are cleansed, the world appears as it is, infinite. In our knowing, we don't see that infinite nature. We see finiteness, the story. So investigation really encourages this curiosity and not knowing that allows us to deepen, to learn, and to be touched. To see anew and to feel that sense of wonder, the wonder also of being surprised. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a saying that goes that this mind, this body, does the bidding of the skillful and the unskillful, the wholesome and the unwholesome. Used unwisely, this mind, this body, ties us to samsara or patterns of repetition. Used wisely, this mind, this body, takes us to nibbana, to liberation. The veiling factors have only really one direction, which is the repetition of patterns of distress and cycles of confusion. The Bhujangas really also have only one direction, the unshakable liberation of the heart. One of the maps that the Buddha draws of our experience goes, what we contact, we feel. What we feel, we perceive. What we perceive, we proliferate about and dwell upon, cling to, and it becomes a shape of our mind. There's another pathway we can follow. What we contact, we feel. What we feel, we perceive. What we perceive, we can inquire into. We can understand. We can care for. And we can respond appropriately. We can be free within. In the development of these limbs of awakening, the qualities that incline us towards awakening, it says that investigation really is the primary root of the next quality, which is virya, energy or courage. I think I want to just take a moment now to pause, actually, before plowing on, give you a chance, if there's a space, to see if there's any questions or reflections you'd like to raise. This is a good time for this.
Robin has a question.
Please.
Hi, thank you so much.
Hi, Robin.
Hello. This is wonderful. I had a question at the last juncture, and what you've just spoken to illuminates that for me a little further. When you were talking about skeptical self-doubt, I had a visceral response to the use of the word skeptical, because my association with it is very mental and it's very positive. It's about curiosity and learning. And so I wondered at the last session if you might speak a little bit more about the seduction of, for me anyway, of that questioning mind when it's paired with doubt becoming a problem, versus what you were just speaking to, which was sort of the what I apprehend is the opposite of that.
I mean, the Buddha very much encouraged skillful doubt, questioning. You know, not to take something for granted, not to believe something because somebody tells you it's true or because it comes from somebody with a lot of authority, you know, to really question. And we, you know, and we see that this is part of every development in science, every development in medicine, every development in psychology, you know, every development on a societal level comes through that questioning, you know. So it has the direction of learning, and it has the direction of opening up fields of understanding. So this is hugely encouraged in the path, in the teaching. But the Buddha speaks about the kind of doubt that is really a veiling factor, is this doubt that actually really undermines all of that, the paralysis of wanting certainty, wanting guarantees, relying upon you know, what we know of not questioning. So the kind of doubt that the Buddha is really talking about being so disempowering is this doubt that is really about my capacity, my ability, my possibilities. You know, and much of that doubt, of course, in people's lives can be truly inherited from voices throughout their life that have told them of their unworthiness, of their inability, because of many reasons. But it might be because of their gender or their ethnicity, or you know, their sexual orientation, you know, or simply because they grew up in families that encourage people to settle for less. You know, so this is what the Buddha is really saying. It's so important to grow through, to emerge from, so that we can enter into that landscape of learning and not knowing and deepening. And so it's really is deeply important to distinguish between these two strands of doubt that can sometimes look quite similar. But we know that paralyzing doubt, you know, we can't make decisions, you know, we have to have guarantees before a decision is made. You know, we falter, we're stuck in place, we're afraid of making changes, you know, we're afraid of upsetting status quo, you know, because of the feedback that we fear we're going to get and not be able to absorb. So really important to really distinguish between these two different threads of doubt, one that paralyzes and one that encourages.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for asking.
And Brock has a question. Go ahead.
Hi, Christina.
Hi.
So just a kind of a reflection of what was coming to mind when you were talking about investigative awareness, both in the mindfulness aspects of it and in the second of the limbs, was its connection to the first noble truth of the task associated with the first noble truth. Of the task, as I understand it, being to understand dukkha, which suggests to me that one needs to inquire. And is that, my question would be, I guess, is that a reasonable way of connecting the Four Noble Truths with the Seven Factors teachings?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, for those of you less familiar, the First Ennobling Truth says, you know, there is dukkha. There is dukkha. There is unsatisfactoriness in life. And, you know, it's a huge umbrella term from what I mentioned around aging, sickness, death, to, you know, all of the psychological, emotional struggles, all of the self-views we can carry, that there is dukkha. There is dukkha held within change often. You know, impermanence is not emotionally neutral, as you may have noticed. You know, there can be a lot of sadness in unwelcome change. Sometimes there's delight in change, but impermanence is not emotionally neutral. To understand dukkha, yes, and it's so the awakening factors are, you know, it's when you look at the different lists, and as you know in the Buddhist teaching, you know, sometimes we're drawing these links, and there's a powerful link between investigation and understanding the first, not only the first ennobling truth, but the second and the third and the fourth. You know, what are the origins of dukkha? You know, we begin to investigate this, you know. Mm-hmm. What is the cessation of dukkha? We begin to consider that possibility. And what is the path? So yes, I think there is a powerful link. It's good you pointed that out. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Naseem has a question.
Thank you.
Hi.
It's, you know, wonderful couple of talks. I have a question related to Robin's question about doubt. And mine is really about trust, which I think is kind of almost seems like the opposite of doubt. But when you were talking, the way I understood it was that it's more than just the absence of doubt. There's a sort of a kind of an enabling sort of quality to it. And it almost feels like you have to be a bit awakened already to kind of be, to trust. And if you're not feeling like that, I mean, how does one generate trust?
And it's a good question, Nassim. Because it's not just about trust and confidence in ourselves and our own possibilities. It's also trust and confidence in the path and in the teaching. You know, and I know in the early years of my practice, when I was so, disabled by doubt, that I was really carried by the confidence that my teachers had in me. You know, that was absolutely critical for me, that my teachers actually, you know, could see the doubt. They just didn't believe it. They just didn't believe it. Which I think is why it is actually one of the reasons, you know, and I don't think that's unfamiliar to many people, you know, that, you know, other people might have more confidence in you at times than we have in ourselves. And they are the benefactors in our life, the people who encourage us and support us and nourish us. And I think it's also the reason why community is so important, you know, because I think doubt thrives in more isolated environments, you know, where we don't have that feedback or that feedback from people who see us through lens different than our own, you know, who actually see the possible rather than the impossible. And I have a feeling this is why actually community is so, so important in this path. Dharma community, where people actually are learning and are teaching themselves to actually see with kindness, see with compassion, see with sensitivity, see with the eyes of possibility rather than the eyes of impossibility. So I don't think we always dig ourselves out of our own holes so easily, I think is what I'm saying, you know, that we need help in digging ourselves out of our own holes, you know, and doubt is one of those, you know, self-doubt, I think, is one of those very deep holes. It's often been kind of like, you know, a story delivered to us through our whole life for some people, you know, of incapability or unworthiness or impossibility. So we actually need help. We need that support. We need community.
I was thinking not so much about self-doubt as kind of doubt in this whole process, this path, you know, and not doubt in it so much as not having trust in it. I don't know. I don't see them as being the same thing.
Are they the same thing? Probably they might be the same thing. You know, it's really hard to know how to answer that because you know, if I talk to people who've been in the practice for a long time, you know, my question would be, what difference does this make in your life? You know, not about what kind of fantastic meditation experiences you've had, but, you know, let me talk to your partner or your kids. You know, let me ask them, what difference has this made in how you live? You know, and I think this is the basis of trust. This is the basis of confidence, is that, you know, this is actually making a difference. We're suffering less. We're appreciating more, you know. We're less beset with low mood. There's more appreciation and joyfulness, you know. There's less of a sense of anxiety. You know, this path is often a simultaneous path of things developing and things falling away. And trust can only be rooted in that process, which is so experiential, you know. So in a way, actually, when you begin this path, for many people, it is a little bit of a leap of faith, you know. People are telling me this is good for me, you know, how do I know? But it doesn't take long in practice. I am awed, totally awed, over and over again by sometimes the really profound shifts I see people make in a very short period of time to undertaking this practice or walking on this path. But we do need those little moments of commitment, you know, not to be standing on the sidelines or on the bank of the river, you know, dabbling our toes. You know, in many ways, we need those moments of commitment to actually allow that to have a possibility of emerging. It's often why I never encourage people like to start the practice. I often actually discourage people from starting with, you know, a one-day retreat or a two-day retreat, you know, especially people when they're really scared, you know, and doubting. I say, in a one-day retreat, two-day retreat, you know, it's like standing near a fire that's just starting. All you get is the smoke in your eyes, you know, that in many ways, you know, go for 10 days, you know, go for a month, you know, actually have a chance for the smoke to clear so that you can actually feel the warmth of the fire.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Missy. Actually, this is just about time for us to pause our session for today, I think. Maybe there's room for one more question, if there is one.
Yes, Kara had a question from the last session. So,
yeah, Kara, go for it.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you and I can see you.
Okay, it's Kara. I'm really appreciating how you've kind of counterbalanced. I've been taught before about the seven factors, and I think I struggle with a sense of them being unattainable. You tell me that they're really here, but I don't see them so much. But when you counterbalance them with these five veils, I found that really intriguing. You know, when I'm really anxious and worried, and I can see that they're very familiar states. Seeing that as a veil and knowing that I need calmness or serenity or tranquility, what was really poignant for me was, you know, imagining that it wasn't that long ago, 10 seconds ago, very anxious. So imagining that and then bringing metta to that awareness actually brings me to the calm that's necessary. So I'm, you know, when you talk about the generative or creative tension between them, I'm seeing how holding all of that and the links between it. Where I get a little stuck, I think, is in the numbness or the dissociation, because there, I seem to lack the energy, even like you've told me that, you know, investigation will bring me into that energy that I need, but I seem to lack, like in dissociation, there's this numbing that has me not even care about my own, you know, experience somehow. I'm just sort of detached and suspended, but still suffering, still acutely uncomfortable, but not having the energy to even push something away or move towards anything.
Under resource, you know? Yeah. And I think there's many roots for that, isn't there? I mean, if you unpack that numbness, you know, really unpack what's lying underneath that numbness, you know, sometimes there's fear, you know, sometimes there's doubt. It's really the state of, I don't want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's often really, I don't want to be here. So I think the place of investigation in this is about, not about how do I get out of the numbness, but what's supporting the numbness. Mm-hmm. You know, is there something here I really just don't want to feel, you know, or don't trust I have the capacity to feel.
Right.
I mean, there's so many ways in which, you know, numbness, I mean, I have to say that, you know, for people with abuse histories, numbness has often been a place of refuge, a valid place of refuge, you know. So I don't want to give this an entirely bad name, you know, because sometimes numbness dissociation has been a survival mechanism. You know, when I talk to people who've been through like major surgeries or illnesses, it's often followed by a period of quite strong dissociation. And in a way, it's the mind protecting itself. You know, it's the heart protecting itself. So I don't want to give this an entirely bad name. You know, sometimes it has been a skillfulness in dissociation and numbness. And that can be true in the present. You know, sometimes the mind and heart is just saying, too much right now, under-resourced, let me check out. You know, and it's not a permanent checkout. It's actually, there's a wisdom in it. Too much, under-resourced, check out. Take a moment for a few breaths. But then I think we always come back, don't we? We always come back. We come back to life as it is. And then that's, I think, the place where we start to not turn this into a pattern. Or if it is a pattern, to understand that it's a pattern that can be untangled. And there's a lot of threads to that untangling. You know, it's not just, it's often energy is looking back to investigation. You know, it's almost like turning around, looking backwards to investigation. But it's also looking forward to joyfulness.
Because it will shift, it's impermanent. Yeah. And I think I'm also getting from you that the inquiry must always be kind. In the numbness, I think I'm more susceptible to that kind of judgmental, impatient inquiry.
And that's very different flavor than investigation. It's an affectionate curiosity. Mm-hmm. Affectionate curiosity. You know, palpating the dullness or the numbness with an affectionate curiosity. You know, what is it that I don't want to be feeling just now? Or is it simply a reality that I feel very under-resourced just now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah? That brings up metta, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So this is not something to condemn, but to respond to.
Yeah.